Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears coming at you here on a Monday morning. Monday, April the 15th, 2024, 15 minutes past the hour, tax day. So I hope everybody has taken care of everything that needs to be done in regard to their 2023 taxes for the year 2024. We are going to start off the morning in a great way because we're going to try to answer a question that a lot of us have tried to answer for a long time in regard to happiness. A new book is out, All That Happiness Is. The author of the book is Adam Gopnik, a staff writer at The New Yorker who has written for the magazine since 1986. He has three National Magazine Awards for essays and for criticism. The author of numerous best-selling books, including Paris to the Moon. What a pleasure it is to welcome the author of All That Happiness Is to these microphones this morning, Adam Gopnik. Adam, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Scott.
Adam, where did the idea for this book come from?
Well, it came proximately, as we say, from a commencement address I gave at my alma mater, McGill University, a couple of years ago. But more broadly, it came from watching my children search for happiness. I have two wonderful kids now in their early 20s. And one of the things that struck me was I was watching them grow up was a kind of division between the things that were being demanded of them by their schools and schoolwork and the things that were giving them the greatest inner pleasure. The schools, of course, drive them towards what I think of as achievement, that is, passing the next test, getting the next grade, eventually getting into the select college and so on. And that is some of the qualities of rats running a rat maze and getting regular shots of sugar water, but not really finding much meaning in the attempt. At the same time, as they were being driven towards what I think of as achievement, they were pursuing for their own sake accomplishments. My son fell in love with the fine art of card magic. And I could see that in these seemingly meaningless but inward-driven accomplishments, they were building a much better foundation for future meaning and for future accomplishment than they were by pursuing test scores and achievements. And that turned me on to the possibility that maybe that was the key to this thing we call happiness.
You know, I think we have to start. What is happiness? It's like, what is love? What is sadness? What is happiness?
Happiness, I guess, for all of us comes in a million different flavors and a million different kinds, or as many kinds of happiness as there are human beings, I suppose. But if there's one thing it seems to me that happiness or fulfillment, whatever word we choose to use, shares or diffuses among people, it's a sense of absorption. Don't you find that's true? That is, it's those moments when we lose ourselves to find ourselves, when we get so enthralled by something we're doing, whether it's raising a child or playing a guitar, that we, all of our fretfulness and all of our usual self-conscious apprehensive care sort of magically evaporates, and all we are is the activity we're pursuing. Plain English, happiness for me is absorption. And the question is, what are the things in life that truly and deeply absorb us?
How do we find those things?
Well, I think we tend to stumble on them, to find them. I begin this little book with the tale of my own experience when I was 12 years old, Scott, and I got a $40 folk guitar and a big book of Beatles songs. This is at the height, well, the Beatle era has never passed, but this was the height of the first Beatle era. And more than anything in the world, I wanted to learn to play those songs. I didn't have a guitar teacher. I didn't know anything much about music, anything at all. But for a couple of weeks, I strenuously poised my hand above the guitar neck, pressing down. My fingers were bleeding. The difficulty of forming chords was enormous. And yet, as like a million other kids, I did. And the moment when I could form those simple chords, a G, a D, and a C, my whole world exploded with possibility, because I understood that the music I loved was part of a series of patterns and tasks, not just something that magically appeared. And that, for me, that experience of making music for the first time, foundation, Scott, of everything else that I've ever done in life. I'm not a musician, as you know. I'm a writer. But I'm able to write because I've had that imprinting experience of what passionate perseverance can produce. So that is the kind of thing we stumble on. The wonderful Scottish poet named Don Patterson. And in his beautiful memoir, he writes about how he stumbled on origami as a poor working-class kid in Dundee, Scotland, about as far removed from the Japanese arts as anyone could be. He stumbled on origami, and for those same crucial adolescent years in his life, all he cared about was making origami elephants and seagulls. He did not become an origami artist. He became a leading poet, but the same process went on for him of finding something that he could master, achieve some mastery in, that then exploded him forward out into the world. And I think if you look at anybody's life has achieved a sense of fulfillment, a sense of happiness of that kind, it rests on the experience of accomplishment.
You know, Adam, this kind of comes back to the question of being a parent, because most parents, if you go up to them and you say, are you happy? They're going to say yes. And of course, they don't regret their children. They would never say that. That would be an awful thing to say for most people. But is that really a sense of happiness? I'm sure you're happy when your kids do good things, but could there be something outside of that?
Oh, of course. I mean, I wouldn't instance raising kids, which is certainly the most satisfying thing I've ever done and the most meaningful thing I've ever done. But not always the happiest thing we've ever done, partly because we're up too early and partly because we're anxious too often. We're concerned about them. We never stop worrying about them if we're engaged with them. What I think we can learn from our kids is what makes them happy. What are the things that they do that are genuinely making them happy? And as I say, in my observation, it tends not to be the achievements we drive them towards, tiger mom-like, in school and in the outer world. It's the things that sit inside themselves that fulfill them. And I think that's true of all of us as we go through life. It's not just something that happens when we're 12 years old, not just something that's confined to adolescence. I think as we go through life, we find that the moments of greatest meaning and moments of greatest sort of self-enhancement, self-awareness, if you like, come when we compel ourselves to pursue some new thing. In the book, I call it the secondary passion. And I say one of the secrets of remaining absorbed, happy in that sense, in life, finding the flow, if you like to use a word some psychologists favor, we find the flow at those moments when we find a new thing to do that we had never been able to do before. My own is cooking, one of my favorite things to do. I will never be a professional cook, but an enormous amount of my time every day is spent planning to chop onions and then chopping onions. And I find enormous inner satisfaction from that action, as millions of other people do as well. And I think it's those secondary passions in life that often fuel our primary vocation. I'm a better writer for being a more passionate cook. The instance I give, the famous proverbial expression in French, Scott, people talk about the violin of Ingres. Now, Ingres, of course, was the great 19th century French neoclassical painter, but all he cared about was his violin. And when he finally put a posthumous museum together, planned it, the violin and the paintbrush had places of equal honor. He was a very great painter and just a so-so violinist, but it was his secondary passion for the violin that constantly fueled and replenished and renewed his passion for painting. I think that's a very sound and familiar model.
You know, it's very interesting. Another thing that seems to bring people a lot of happiness, or they think will bring them a lot of happiness, is money. Most people will say, well, you got to have money to live. If I didn't have to worry about my bills, if I didn't have to worry about my house, if I didn't have to go to work every day, if I didn't have to be dependent on these things, I would be a happy person. Can money be tied to happiness?
Well, like all of us here on Tax Day today, I am worrying about money. I will not put on airs and pretend that I am a high being above it. I'm very concerned about paying my taxes, about making enough to pay last year's taxes and making enough money this year to have taxes to pay next year. None of us can escape the needs for material success, if you like, for material comfort, certainly. So I don't mean for a second to condescend to our need for those things. We can't have happiness at all, obviously, if we don't have some base level of material comfort. And one of our tasks as citizens is to try and be sure that all of our fellow citizens have at least that base, that foundation of material well-being, because the anxiety from not having it corrodes our possibility of having any other kind of happiness. We need to say that and always put it at the forefront of our imagination. Having said that, as Larry David says, I think we all know perfectly well that there's no correlation, no very robust correlation between the amount of money someone has and the sense of inner satisfaction that they have. We know of Zen monks who have nothing but have everything, and we know of incredibly wealthy people who live their lives in a kind of miasma of resentment and grievance and unhappiness. And I name no names. So it's obvious that money alone is not enough to assure that inner sense of absorption, contentment, of escaping ourselves to find ourselves, that I think is all that happiness is.
Can there be a false happiness that may result, or start with money, that may result in a false happiness that, you know, I'm not doing too well, I'm down on my luck, I'm paying the bills, but I don't have the money to maybe take the vacation or do the thing I want to do, and then all of a sudden, oh, here's some money, or maybe you start living with somebody and your bills are cut in half. Can that create a happiness?
It certainly creates an improvement, doesn't it? I mean, we know that experience. Is they're hitting you over the head with a mallet. When they stop hitting you over the head, you feel much better. But that, I think, is, if you like, it's kind of negative form of happiness. That is you have less exterior pain to hurt you, to harm you. But I think when we're talking about all that happiness is, we're not just talking about removing the bad experience or the bad stimulus, if you like. We're talking about actually moving forwards to something that seems to give us an enlightened sense of meaning. You know, it's fascinating to me, Scott, and it's where I start the book, that it's included in our foundational document here in the United States, is the pursuit of happiness. Now, we're so accustomed to that language from the Declaration of Independence, but I don't think we often stop to think about what a peculiar and original demand or possibility that is. We have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I did a little detective work about where that phrase comes from. It comes from a 17th century philosopher named John Locke. But when John Locke was talking about the pursuit of happiness, he thought it only counted when you achieved it. That was what he was talking about, not so much the pursuit as the capture of happiness. I think it's a very modern idea, very American idea in many ways, that the pursuit of happiness is meaningful in itself. That one of the ways that we find meaning in life is to pursue our own personal style of bliss or joy. And that, I think, is the positive side of happiness. We know about the negative side, and it's very important. When they stop hitting us over the head with the mallet, we feel better. And there's lots of ways in which life hits us over the heads with mallets, and we want to remove those. That's absolutely true. But I think we also want to pursue this somewhat more elevated sense of inner contentment, of absorption. And that seems to come from the pursuit of accomplishment, from the pursuit of meaningful experience. You know, every psychologist who studies it will tell you that what makes people happy are not possessions, not material goods, but experiences. We don't have to be puritanical about it. Nothing wrong with possessions. But that doesn't seem to be where happiness lodges. It lodges in the weight and in the intensity of our experiences. We look back on those things, the significant trip we took, the significant moment that we shared with someone else, when we think about our moments of supreme happiness.
You know, it's always very interesting to me because I like to ask people why they're going into the field they're going into once they tell me what that field is. And more in recent years, I would say the last 6 or 7 years, when you ask somebody that, they'll tell you what field they want to go into, and I'll say, well, why do you want to go into that field? And the answer seems to be, well, you can make this much money, or there are this many positions available for it. And I always think, you know, boy, that could end very badly.
That, it sounds like a waste of life, doesn't it? I mean, I I'm blessed, Scott, and I think you maybe too. We get to do the thing we love to do. Now, writing is something that I've always loved and something that I feel I do well and that is fulfilling for me. And there are too many people in the world who don't get to do the thing they love, and I don't want to preen on my own ability to do it. But I'd add that I think that there's nobody in the world who doesn't have some action, some activity, some secondary passion that does give them enormous satisfaction. It's been one of the pleasures of going out on the road with this book and its predecessor, my previous book called The Real Work on the Mystery of Mastery, to find that everywhere I went, I was meeting people, many of them older people, midlife people, who had an enormous passion for something, for writing haiku or doing batik, and they felt that those passions were being condescended to as hobbies, mere hobbies, when in fact they were the burning fire that lit their inner self. And I want to dignify all those countless millions of little inner fires that illuminate ourselves, because I think that they are the key to human contentment.
You know, Adam, something that's interesting to me, aside from money and aside from the other things we've talked about when it comes to happiness, is a lot of people do not seem happy if they do not have a significant other. It could be somebody they're married to, boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever it is, in their life. If they do not have that, it just doesn't work for them. Can you find happiness in another person?
I don't think you can find happiness in another person, but I think you can find happiness and perhaps can only find happiness alongside another person. I think that it's one of the great themes of European literature, American literature, is our search for happiness in the ideal lover, in the ideal person. And usually in that literature, almost invariably in that literature, it doesn't work out, whether it's Romeo and Juliet or Lancelot and Guinevere. We love to hear about people who lose themselves in another person, but it isn't a very useful model of human fulfillment. It isn't meant to be. It's meant to be a model of human aspiration of a different kind. So I think it's hard to find yourself in another person. On the other hand, I don't know of anybody who doesn't feel that being able to share their own search for fulfillment, their own love and desire to become a better poet, accountant, talk show host, writer, doesn't gain more satisfaction from being shared with one particular person. And I think we've all found that with our spouses, sometimes with our children, with our lovers. That's, I think, the foundation of a happy marriage. I once wrote a book about Charles Darwin, you know, Scott, and I asked myself the question, what are the secrets to a happy marriage? Because Darwin had a very happy marriage with his wife, Emma. And I said, I think the secrets to a happy marriage are a combination of lust, laughter, and loyalty. You have to have lust to get started at all, and you have to have laughter, common laughter, to sustain all of the awkward moments outside of lust. And finally, you have to have profound loyalty between the two people to stick by each other. And that, I think, is a very human compound of love between husbands and wives, husbands and husbands, wives and wives, and all the different arrays that we experience it now, is that ability not just to have the great overwhelming emotions of lust and romantic love, but to see them settle into laughter and loyalty. And the laughter and loyalty is usually provoked by our independent searches for fulfillment, and in which we can turn to each other and say, let me tell you the latest.
It's kind of interesting to me because I look at a lot of people in this day and age, and I see people who have been in and out of several relationships, and many of them who have been in and out of several marriages. And if you ask them when they're in it, they'll say they're happy, and they'll say, you know, they'll use those terms, this is the one, I've never met anybody like this before, but then it does come to an end. So are they...
The next one comes on, right? Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So are they happy or just temporarily in some kind of a false happiness because they seem to repeat this routine several times?
Well, you know, that's another one of the great kind of mythological types that we know is the Don Juan on the masculine side and the Don Juanesque on the feminine side. That is, people are perpetually cycling through new relationships, new lovers, and each time they tell you exactly as you say, Scott, this is the one. I finally found it. And those people, too, very often tend to be people who cycle through lots of ambitions, accomplishments, and they tell you, now I'm a an improv comedian, now I found it. Now I'm doing Jungian analysis, now I found it. And that they tend to be people, very lovable very often, who are cyclical people or perpetually dissatisfied with the face they face and perpetually searching for another face. And that's part of the human condition, certainly. I think that if you look at people who seem to have a kind of more stable and solid foundation for their own pursuit of meaning, that they tend to rest it not in the relentless pursuit of new things, but in the continual pursuit of one or two things. And I've given my own eccentric example of playing the guitar. You know, Scott, I still love to play the guitar. You could see the room that I'm speaking to you from. It's filled with guitars, some of them my own, some of them my son. My son went on, I mentioned him earlier, you know, somebody who found great satisfaction and accomplishment in doing card tricks originally, but at about the age of 16, he discovered, as so many young men have done before him, that girls have absolutely no interest in card tricks. So he turned to the guitar, and now my room is filled with some of the guitars he left behind when he went to university. Like all guitarists, he told me that I could play them anytime I wanted, just so long that I never touched them. But I think that my own playing guitar is something that I've gone on with. I've done professionally exactly once, not professionally, but on stage once, with James Taylor, of all people, you know, the great singer-songwriter. I interviewed him for the New Yorker festival, and I asked him to give me a guitar lesson on stage, and being an enormously generous gentleman, he did, and that was the highlight of my life. I'm never going to be a guitar player, but the satisfaction I take in getting a little bit better at the guitar every year after 50 years now of doing it is, as I said before, Scott, for me, that's the foundation that makes everything else possible. I can always put the guitar into my hands and master some small new thing, and that empowers me, energizes me, enables me to then turn to my real work, the thing I do for a living, the thing I do professionally, and do it with a much greater sense of satisfaction and serenity.
Do you feel that people kind of poo-poo those things that they refer to, as we said earlier, as hobbies? That if they have a family and they have a husband, wife, whatever it may be, whatever combination of family they might have going, and they have a job that pays the bills and they don't have to struggle for money, they look at somebody who is doing something that maybe is outside of the box or not near that, but maybe might make that person happy, and go, why do you do that? Why do you need that? What's the point of that?
Yes, I think that's a terrific problem, issue, if you like, in our civilization, that we tend to condescend to people who are engaged in some hobby. You know, as I said, when I was out on the road with my previous book, The Real Work, You learn about the book you've written after you've written it, and you share it with people. And one of the things I learned about that book that I had no idea was going to happen is that it spoke to late-in-life learners. And I've come now to talk to a lot of groups of late-in-life learners, people often retired, who've taken up a new thing. And as we said a moment ago, are rightly confused or indignant when people kind of treat it with a pat on the head and a kind of, there, you go do your batik or watercolor or haiku or whatever it might be that you're pursuing. In fact, everything we know, from both from our own experience, our own immediate experience, and everything we can read about the nature of mental health, tells us that it's people who are pursuing new passions in their later years, whether that new passion will ever flourish, will ever blossom into some profession, doesn't matter. Those are the people who are on the track of happiness and finding meaning. And so if we could banish the word hobbies from our our lexicon, it would make me enormously happy. I think of the happy, that would be one thing that would make me happy. I call them in my book, All That Happiness Is, secondary passions. And secondary passions fuel our primary pursuits. I think that's a genuine rule of life. So let's get rid of the word hobbies, and let's certainly stop the practice of patronizing seniors who are pursuing their secondary passions.
You know, Adam, it's also very interesting. As you said, you have accomplished a lot and done a lot of great things with your career, but yet the greatest moment of your life was being on stage with James Taylor. Now, if you are able to get to that moment in life where you're doing what makes you the happiest and you achieve something maybe you thought you could never achieve in that happiness, do you find it hard to explain that to somebody else who maybe is just getting by day to day? Now, they're happy. I'm not saying they're not happy, but they have never gotten to that point.
Well, I would never want to point to my own case as being in any sense, superior or admirable. I grope for happiness like everybody else, and I spend a fair share of my time groaning and agonizing, feeling frustrated, exasperated, often these days feeling terribly frightened and alarmed by what's happening in our public world, in our public sphere, in the terrifying ways in which we seem to be sleepwalking towards dictatorship and the rest of it. I don't for a second want to portray myself as being somehow a complacent indulger in my own contentment. Just the opposite is true. But I do think that when we ask ourselves, how do we escape from the world of aggravation and grievance and worry, we can turn both to the psychologists, to the mystics, and to our own experience and say, when have I had that feeling? When has life seemed particularly good to me? And almost invariably, as I've been saying in this conversation, those moments when we escape ourselves to find ourselves, moments when we lose ourselves in some larger system, some larger passion, some larger work, could be meditation, could be the folk guitar, could be cards, could be sewing patterns. Some of those then turn into professions, but they don't start as professions. They start as the satisfaction of accomplishment, I really do think.
As you look around, are people happy, would you say? Have people found their happiness on the whole?
You know, it's a funny kind of thing. It's like, people always say when they do surveys, do you trust the government? And they all say, no, absolutely not. And then you say, do you like your local congressman or city councilor? And they say, yes, yeah, make an exception. And so I think that though as a society, we seem to be goaded by unhappiness. We seem to be terribly discontent much of the time. We live in an atmosphere of grievance and frustration. But when you talk to individual people, they almost always have something in their lives that does give them that sense of satisfaction, individually or directly, though they may say that the world sucks, but this is good. This was some specific thing that I'm passionate about. Could be Jeeps or cars or electric guitars or barbecue, something that I do feel satisfying to me. And I do think that everybody who lives a healthy life finds that it's part of the good health of it is finding time simply to shut off all of the outside noise and search for that inner sense. You know, it's whether it's the Buddhists who insist that what we have to do is, tamp down our constant noise of wanting and needing and just get in tune with the world, or it's the music teacher who tells you just do the scale. There's a kind of commonality amongst all of the wisdom that we've accumulated over millennia about human happiness, and it all turns towards turning off the outside noise and opening up the inside doors.
You know, the great irony to all this happiness to me is that almost everybody you talk to, if you talk to them long enough, no matter what they're doing in life, whether it be their job or their family or just day-to-day operations, they might be happy, and they might tell you they're happy, but they always have a thing, whether it's writing, whether it's broadcasting, whether it's working with animals, whatever it is, there's always this thing that they might not have time for, that they've not had a chance to get to, that they bring up. Now, they don't always refer to it as that's what's going to bring them happiness, but there's always that thing.
Yes, that's a good alternative title for my book. There's always this thing. There's always this thing. Because there is always this thing. Everybody knows. Everybody has a strong intuitive sense of something that they know brings them satisfaction. It's something that they, if they pursue it, brings them that sense of flow, of what I call accomplishment, of mastery. And it can be something that's very remote from their current work. And I think that everybody has that thing. And the purpose of this little book of mine, All That Happiness is to encourage people to pursue that thing unashamedly, unapologetically. Doesn't matter if it's not on the main road leading towards worldly success. It doesn't matter if it doesn't have a dollar sign attached. Pursuing it, that thing, will bring you a sense of satisfaction that will fuel everything else you do.
You know, and it all comes back again to what you just said. No dollar sign attached to it. I recently, not to get too personal here with somebody else's... Yeah, well, with somebody else's story is what I want to say here, but they had never dreamed about being in a certain field, and they got the opportunity to be in that certain field, and they were already on the path to another field. Now, this is somebody in their early 20s, and all of a sudden, they realize this thing that they never really thought about doing is something they have great passion for, and now that they're on their trek to another field, they don't want to leave this other thing now that has come out of the blue. And I think that's very interesting. It puts you in a precarious position for this at this point in their life.
Well, they're blessed to be so young, right? To be in your 20s. One of the things my dad, a man of immense wisdom, always used to say, everybody has to at least 30, maybe even 35, to experiment, to find out what it is you're really passionate about. If I have a clue, you know, it's so funny. I was just talking to my own daughter last night over dinner. She's in her early 20s, just had a wonderful career opportunity. And what I was saying to her, the little bit of wisdom I've gained in life, is to say, it's wonderful you have this great career opportunity, a chance to a kind of promotion within her first job. But make sure it's the thing you feel most passionately about. Because it's always wonderful when the world is giving you signals saying, you do this well, you can do it. Well, we appreciate you. We can do it better. But it can be a kind of trap because it may not be the thing that you feel most passionately about deep inside. And since everything is difficult, pursuing anything is difficult, pursue the thing you're most passionate about because they're all going to be equally difficult in the pursuit, whether it's, you know, playing the violin or running an art museum or building a business. All of those things are hard. Make it the one that matters most to you. And that's the important advice for us all to get. My dad, as I said, always said, take till you're 30 at least to figure out what it is you want to do. So I think your friend has plenty of time. And we all know, don't we? I mean, I'm sure you and I both know, Scott, lots of people who look back at 45 or 50 and say, well, this has been remunerative, whatever it is I've chosen to do. It's been remunerative and it's worked out well. But gosh, I wish I'd done that other thing. Life is too short to live with those regrets, I think.
You know, word for word, that's what I told the person, because they've asked me about this. And I said, you know, do what you want to do. You've got to do what you want to do here. Nobody can make that decision for you. But just don't be in your 40s. Because at this point, you don't have a family. You don't have children. Don't get to that point and then sit there and go, I wish I would have. That's the big problem.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it's funny, that was exactly the counsel I was giving to my own wonderful daughter last night. And I think it's counsel that any of us who've had experience of life learns to give. Look, I don't mean to underestimate the degree to which I've had lots of good fortune in my life. There are so many millions of our fellow citizens who are struggling just to get through the day, who, you know, aren't able to, don't have the time or the bandwidth, as our kids say, to think about, well, I'd rather be doing Japanese origami. That's a special kind of province of adolescence, and it's a reflection of some kind of good fortune and all of that. But I do think that sense of satisfaction and accomplishment is available to everybody. I just, yesterday afternoon, and forgive me if I digress just a little bit, I attended a wonderful play called The Castle, about formerly incarcerated people who have struggled to find new lives for themselves. And one of the fascinating things that they talked about was being in prison, actually in prison, Scott, and then discovering something outside themselves. For one of the witnesses, one of the people who's talking, discovered playwriting. He'd never seen a play in his life, but he started reading drama, August Wilson, Arthur Miller, and finally found, after a life of misery and suffering and wrongdoing, had found some way of organizing his emotions. So I think that that's available even to the most unfortunate of us all the time, and it's one of the things that we should struggle to share with our fellow citizens as much as we can.
You know, Adam, one of the things I find fascinating in our last 10 minutes here is accomplishment versus achievement. Now, a lot of people see those as the same thing. What is or are the big differences there?
Well, if there's any originality to this little book of mine, and I should emphasize it's a very short book meant to be a quick and funny and appealing read. It's not a heavy-duty sermon of any kind. If there's any originality to this book, it's exactly, I think, that I make that distinction. Exactly as you say, Scott, for most people, achievement and accomplishment are synonyms. They mean the same thing. They're just different words we use to describe the same thing. For me, they point to very different things. Achievement for me, as I've said, is the outer-directed, outer-imposed acts of social ambition, whether it's passing the test or getting into select college or getting the better job, all of those things that we do because other people want us to do them. That's achievement in my vision of the world. Accomplishment, on the other hand, are the inner directed. In some ways, not success-oriented, not goal-oriented, if you like. All of those things that we do for the satisfaction of having done them. And they range, as I say, from making fashion patterns to sew to forming guitar chords to learning card tricks. Those are all the kind of things we do for ourselves because they're meaningful to us. And the case I'm trying to make in this book is that those accomplishments, even if they don't play an immediate role in our life in the world, are a much firmer foundation for everything else we do than the blind and relentless pursuit of achievement that our society imposes on us and particularly on our kids.
Do you think society in some way has looked at what we used to call the nuclear family and say, you know, you've got the husband, you've got the wife, you've got the kids, you've got the nice house, you've got a nice car, you get 2 or 3 weeks off every year to take a vacation, and that is happiness. That's what you work toward. And it's not really these sort of offbeat things, as people would call them, maybe in music or maybe anything in the arts, really. And because that is looked upon as, you know, 3 weeks in Cape Cod, that's what you work for, that truly is happiness.
Well, I will plead guilty here, Scott, because 3 weeks in Cape Cod is always what I've worked for. It takes literally for that to take my family for 3 weeks in August to Cape Cod has always seemed to me to be the ultimate achievement, if you like, in my life. So, I'll plead guilty to that sin. But, you know, once you're in Cape Cod, so to speak, once you have some kind of base level of comfort and well-being, what matters is learning to surf. You know, why you go to Cape Cod is because you get to do things that you don't get to do the rest of the year, and you learn to, you learn to surf. It's something else that you want to do. Happiness, even when we're lucky and doing the things that we're allowed to do, encouraged to do by our social arrangements, we always are looking for some way to find meaning within that. We go to the Audubon Nature Walk, and we learn to discriminate between the kinds of birds or the types of frogs, and so on. So I don't want to, condescend to the normal search for happiness, in which I entirely share. And, of course, strong family relationships, strong marriages, loving back and forth with our kids, those are essential. And this, again, is, I think, I hope, one of the new things that I'm adding to this conversation. We're able to do those most when we're coming at them not from neediness, but from a sense of inner accomplishment, from a sense of inner satisfaction. People we most like to spend time with, I think we always find, are people who have a strong sense of themselves that's rooted in something that they do well. Those are the people who bring the most to the table. And the people who bring the least most often are the ones who are neediest for outer approval because they haven't constructed that sense of inner satisfaction, of absorption in something outside themselves that is, I think, all that happiness is.
You know, Adam, in our last 5 minutes, one of the things I have been paying more attention to as of late, so it's interesting we're having this conversation, is I will look at people, maybe it's just curiosity, and I always think, I wonder if that person really is happy. Because if you ask them if they're happy, they will say yes. And I truly believe that they think they are, or why would they be doing what they're doing in most cases? I think they do think they're happy, but their body language and their answers to certain questions do not seem to line up with what they're saying. So do you think people know that they're not necessarily happy?
Remember that wonderful scene in Woody Allen's Annie Hall, right, where he comes up to the gorgeous couple and says, "Are you too happy?" And they say, "Well, we're such shallow, empty people that anything makes us happy, right?" And so I guess we sometimes feel that way about others. I think that, you know, I would never, as I say, I never want to patronize anybody else's sense of accomplishment or anybody else's witness to their own inner happiness. All of us find it in different ways if we're lucky enough to find it at all. I do think that the people who have brought me the strongest sense to radiate, infuse us with the strongest sense of all that happiness is, tend to be people who don't talk that much about their happiness, but who enact it in the things that they do and in the passions that they show. So I would never question somebody's own witness to it, but I would watch what they do, not what they say.
Are goals important? Is it important to have goals?
You know, we all have goals, but in the immortal words of John Lennon, life is what happens to you when you're busy making other plans. The goals we pursue tend to rebound against us, tend to elude us, tend to surprise us when we've got them. John Lennon, bless his memory, is a beautiful example of somebody who pursued worldly success and found that it was not as satisfying as he had hoped it would be, even though he got it at the largest possible level any human being has, and who found happiness at the end of his life, tragically short, in caring for his son, in baking bread for his son. That became the real source of profound happiness in his life. And I think that that's a good lesson. We should pursue goals, but very often the goal will turn around and pursue us and reveal to us what it is we should have been pursuing all along.
Adam, I'm going to throw you a long pass here with 2 minutes left to go. How has technology affected happiness?
Well, that's a big question of our time, isn't it? And, you know, there's a lot of people, there's a new book by a guy named Jonathan Haidt that says that the smartphone is destroying our children's chance at happiness. It's a little distraction machine. Instead of offering us a positive absorption of the kind that I've been describing in our conversation, it offers us mere frustrating distraction. And that may be true, but I've lived long enough to know that at every moment, whatever the new technology is supposed to be something that fragments all of our possibilities of satisfaction and happiness, whether that was the newsreel or television. I grew up, as perhaps you did, in the era of television when all of the wise men and women were saying, television is poison. Television is destroying our kids' minds and fragmenting their attention. And now we find ourselves in a situation where you go into your teenager's room and you say, please get off your phone and come watch television with your family, because television is now the communal thing. I tend to think that those things exist in a much kind of steadier state of technological distraction. I don't mean to diminish it, and I certainly was always telling my kids, put down your phone. Absolutely no phones at the dinner table. Conversation is much more important than one more fragmentary text. And I believe that passionately. But I think we can be a little less agitated about technology and a little more committed to accomplishment. Mm.
The book is short, but it is a great book. All That Happiness Is. Adam Gopnik is the author, New York Times staff writer for many, many years. Adam, this has been a fascinating conversation, and I hope that you are having a happy morning.
Scott, I've enjoyed every bit of this conversation. The New Yorker magazine is where I am, not the Times.
Oh,
but I've enjoyed this conversation entirely. And I'm having a happy morning because we had a good conversation.
Thank you, Adam.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. See, if I could have gotten that right, I would have been happy.
You're listening to The Talking Place from Charlie Evers.
Yeah, you know, you could come in handy, too, with that electricity if we have problems with our transmitter, which is above you.
I know.
Yeah. All you'd have to do is raise your hands and energize our transmitter.
To formerly of WNCI, Weasel Boy,